Thanks for joining me today. It's a delight to have David Kessler make a return visit to this program. He's got a new book out, Finding Meaning, The Sixth Stage of Grief. I'm Richard Brendan, and you're listening to Journey's Fire. You know, in the book on grief and grieving, it came out in 2005, David Kessler and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross introduced the five stages for grief: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Now the world's foremost on healing and loss has discovered a new stage of grief, meaning. David Kessler has taught physicians, nurses, counselors, police, and first responders about grief and has led talks and retreats for those experiencing grief. But after the accidental death of his son, Kessler felt called to revisit the five stages of grieving. What happens when a tragedy strikes the world's most well-known grief expert? Acceptance couldn't be the final stage. Meaning was necessary for healing. So in this new book, Finding Meaning, with the permission of the Kubler-Ross Family Foundation, he added this crucial new sixth stage of grief, the stage where hope and healing can often be found. David Kessler is indeed the world's most well-known expert on grieving. He worked closely with the legendary Elizabeth Kubler-Ross for the last decade of her life. They co-authored actually two best-selling books, On Grief and Grieving and Life Lessons, Kessler's first book, The Needs of the Dying. He also wrote Visions, Trips, and Crowded Rooms, Who and What You See Before You Die. Kessler has co-authored with Louise Hay. He's a founder of Grief.com, which has over 5 million visitors, and he lives in Los Angeles, and it's a delight to have him join us today. David Kessler, welcome to the program.
Glad to be with you, Richard.
I love this new book. I've read all of your books, actually, and you were on this show, I think, gosh, maybe 5 years ago regarding one or two of them. But with my hospice background as well, I love the title. Of course, you're a gifted writer and have much to share. It's just laid out so beautifully. So first of all, thank you for that. But I want to open up with this, David, that not long ago I read an article in doing some research for this interview that you stood before a Los Angeles audience to lead a grief workshop, but you didn't address them simply as an expert in the field, which you are. You're also a survivor because of the loss of your son, David.
And I am.
And you dedicated this book actually to both your boys.
Right.
But can you share a little bit about that first as we start? What was that like? You got a phone call, I believe, from Richard.
Sure. My kids had always, we always were calling 911, you know, when we saw a car broken down. And because we're on the same phone plan, we would get notifications. And I got a notification that, one of my sons had dialed 911. And I thought, oh, there's, you know, an accident or whatever it may be. And unfortunately, it turned out that my younger son, David, had died. So after all these decades of grief work, and I think, you know, I had so much grief and loss in my childhood as a, you know, 13-year-old. I had my mother die while there was a mass shooting going on. I thought, well, most of my grief is behind me.
Yeah.
And I'm sure when I'm 80, you know, all my friends will start dying. But, you know, life has other plans for us and other things happen and loss happens. And so, yeah, I, you know, found myself in the epicenter of grief also, you know, as a father more than an expert and, you know, had to deal with it. And it's interesting also, you know, you mentioned the new book. I had, you know, heard so many stories of people who had found meaning after their spouse died or after their parents died. And I was always fascinated by that. Had often thought, I wonder, could that be the sixth stage of grief? And I knew after my son died, I didn't want to just stop at acceptance. I needed more, and I thought that was meaning.
It clearly so. Not only based on your experience as an expert, but also now going through a loss that I can't even believe what that was like going through. And thank goodness you're
Well, it certainly is, you know, a loss I don't wish on anyone, and it's brutal. And, you know, it's been challenging, but it's, you know, we have to find a way that makes sense for us, and writing this book and making meaning and, you know, going on and interviewing so many people with all different kind of losses, from spouses to pets to siblings, certainly has been my cushion. You know, meaning doesn't take away the pain.
No.
But it does become a cushion to it.
That's so true. And we each do it in our own way. You said once, I believe in an interview, that we live in a world that doesn't want to allow you to experience grief. We live in a society that wants you to just get over it and move on. And that's,
right.
That's
right.
Something,
and
yeah.
We're a very grief illiterate society, which you know from your work. And, you know, we have to learn to talk about this. And I often say, in some ways, I'm teaching people what our grandparents, great-grandparents knew how to do. They knew how to deal with loss and to just be with it. We are now this productive society that wants to figure it out and get through it and minimize it.
Yeah, that's, we like to compartmentalize it, that's for sure. And we just can't do that. And you know that more than anyone. And by the way, you've got the domain grief.com. I was always impressed with that. So if anybody wants information on grief, all they have to do is Google that. And that's a very interactive website you have. You were honored and had the privilege of working alongside, even co-writing some books with the great Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And, of course, out of that came her view of the five stages of grief. And I believe in honor of her, you contacted her, the society, and asked, hey, I want to add another one to it.
Yeah, I'll tell you, Elizabeth and I had written Life Lessons together, and then we adapted her stages from dying to grief. And we had talked about, is there more? You know, is there a sixth stage? And I'll tell you, we'd often had so much uncomfortableness with how, you know, the stages have been misinterpreted, that they're rigid and you move from one to another and they've got to be in order. And, you know, as you know, grief doesn't work like that. And I often find it funny that, you know, Elizabeth was such an organic, messy, rule-breaking person that sometimes someone will go, oh, Elizabeth, and you were just trying to neaten up our grief. And I can tell you, grief is not neat.
Yeah.
And there's certainly no rules to it or one model.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just, as you mentioned, so honored that the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross Foundation and her family allowed me to add a sixth stage to her iconic stages.
You know, when I heard the title and then I read your book, it's amazing. It just made total sense to me that that would be a sixth stage. Because that's been my experience in my own grief work, and then assisting others or companioning them, I would see that happen too. So I'm so grateful you're putting it out there in this book, into the world, for people to really understand that. You've said also the baby boomers, and you just weren't satisfied to stop at acceptance. There was something missing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing that happened in our society is that acceptance sort of took on a finality that Elizabeth and I never met. You know, when people ask me how long will I grieve or how long is my friend going to grieve, I always say, well, how long are they going to be dead? Because if our loved ones are going to be dead for a long time, we're going to grieve for a long time.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean we will always grieve with pain. We can grieve in time at our own pace with love.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did meaning help you during and since the passing of your own son?
Well, writing this book and just, you know, going through and researching everyone else's stories and then noticing even what my mind would do with his death. And I was so curious as I heard stories with other people and even watching my own mind.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to know about the brain science. Why do we focus on the negative thing? Why do we get focused on the death? What makes it so hard to find meaning? And by the way, you had mentioned grief.com. When I think about how hard this is, I also put together a companion class for the book that's free to anyone who buys it. And just know they can find info at that at grief.com or at sixthstage.com. Because I think it is hard when you're in grief to find the meaning, and that's why I wanted to give people lots of resources to do it.
Oh, that's wonderful, David. You know, one of the things you say in the book is that in grief, pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. What do you mean by that?
Well, I can't take anyone's pain away, nor would I want to. Your pain is part of the lot.
Mm-hmm.
But our mind will make so much noise and make so many comments. You would think that our mind would be our kindest organ after, you know, there's been a loss or a tragedy. And yet our mind wants to blame us, blame other people, tell us we're never going to love again. So many other things our brain does to us that works against us. And all that noise and commenting it makes is the suffering. So when I say pain from loss is inevitable, I can't change your pain. I'm going to miss my son. People are going to miss their parents, their spouse, their siblings, their pets.
Mm-hmm.
But I can help them get to the pure grief and help them release some of that suffering.
Yeah, there's a big difference between the two, isn't there?
Certainly is.
Some people like to hold on to suffering, don't they?
Well, I think what happens is we get stuck. I think the pain becomes very familiar. And we know with brain science now that, you know, neurons that fire together wire together. You know, there's a time in grief where, of course, we need to tell the death story. We need to tell what happens.
Mm-hmm.
We even need it witnessed.
Mm-hmm.
But there becomes a time also, as our early grief sort of turns into mature grief, that all of a sudden we can get stuck in the story of their death and forget their life. And I don't want my son's, you know, story and history to be only his death. I want it to be about his life.
Is there a way when you're in conversation with somebody and they're camping out maybe a little too much in the death part, is there a tactful way of spinning it around, turning it around to say, tell me about his life, and that opens them up to change a little bit?
Well, that's what happens, that, you know, our minds are like Velcro for the bad and Teflon for the good.
Yes.
And, you know, so sometimes, obviously, in grief early on, mm-hmm. we tell our stories, we witness our stories. But later on, you know, I talk about, we've all heard the story about the end of our loved one's life. Tell me about the middle.
Yeah.
Tell me about the beginning.
Yeah.
Tell me about their 10th birthday. Tell me what you two were like when you were growing up together as siblings. Tell me about your 10th anniversary. So we can ask questions about the other times to help, you know, a person's mind not get stuck in just how they died. Because that is our tendency.
Yeah, absolutely. It's also a tendency, I think, for people to feel uncomfortable when they're around folks who are in grief, when they just don't know what to say because they don't want to say the wrong thing. They may even just go silent and say nothing. What's the best way, David, to comfort another person who's lost someone close to them?
Well, it's interesting. That is sort of the most visited page on grief.com is the best and worst things to say to people in grief. And I think where we get lost is we want to fix people in grief, and we have to remember they're not broken. They're not broken, they're in grief. And that also means that our job isn't to point out the silver lining. Oh, isn't it good they died quick? Or isn't it good she's not suffering? Or whatever it may be. But instead to know grief is not about doing. Grief is about being.
Mm-hmm.
Can we just be with them?
Mm-hmm.
Can we just sit with them? Can we just say, oh, my gosh, I don't know what your pain's like, but I'm just here with you, and you're not alone.
Mm. And part of that, I think, is being gentle with ourselves. You also have said, our hearts know how to grieve, but our minds work against us. Wouldn't it be great if we felt more love and compassion for ourselves in grief? We don't do that very well, do we?
No, we have a lot of protective mechanisms in our mind that work so well at other times.
Mm.
However, then we get to grief, and our mind is trying to protect.
Yeah.
And it's a time for vulnerability, not a time for protection.
Mm. Vulnerability, that's where it's at, and that really opens up the heart, doesn't it? That's a scary place for some people to be. We like to have our hearts protected.
Absolutely, except the reality is it may not be an enjoyable world and life that honors our loved one
mm-hmm.
if we get stuck in that protection mode.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, people always ask me, is there life after death for our loved ones? And I say, I believe there is. But there's another question. Is there life after death for us? Can we live again? Can we live again a life that honors them?
Yeah. In all the years, all the decades that you have taught and written on grief, and I'm thinking about those words, vulnerability and protection, walling us off, what was your personal experience like when you got the news of your son? Because to me, as a father, there's nothing harder than hearing about the loss of a child.
It was devastating. It was shocking. You know, it's interesting. I wrote the book, and I did not put in my own story until the end because
mm-hmm.
I wanted people to know this story. This book is not about me. This is about them and their grief.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I said, and I knew, is everything has changed. I knew that moment changed everything, and that became the title of that last chapter.
Yeah.
And I think anyone who's been through grief sort of knows, oh my gosh, you know, these are moments that change us forever.
Mm.
Whether it's our parent or our sibling, you know, we are changed by these moments.
Not as a teacher or writer, but when you were going through that, did you find that there was a slight tendency to want to protect yourself, to not feel the depth of that pain, or were you able to just take a deep dive and curl up?
I think I did all those things. I think I curled up.
All the above, yes.
I think I took a deep dive. I think I avoided it. I can remember early on, Diane Gray, who's a hospice specialist and also a bereaved parent and was the head of the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross Foundation at one point, she called me and she said, I know you're drowning.
Mm.
But she said at a certain point, you are going to hit bottom.
Yeah.
And when you do, you have a decision to make. Do you swim again or stay at the bottom?
Mm.
And that really made me think about that meaning and that decision. And the other thing about, you know, being the grief specialist, I mean, one thing I learned that I had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
I've been someone who's been telling people for years, go to grief counseling, go to grief support groups, da 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 da. I know you don't want to, but they might be helpful.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, when I had to take my own advice, just go into my first grief support group. I mean, the traffic was bad. Oh, I shouldn't even go. Then it was hard to park. Oh, don't bother. And then I had to go into a room with other people with my book 3 feet away and no one knowing it was me. And just sit there and just be a father.
That's vulnerability.
And the same thing, absolutely, the same thing when I went to grief counseling, people go, well, what did you talk about in grief counseling?
Yeah.
Well, I talked about my son and my grief and,
mm-hmm.
you know, despite knowing about grief, this was my grief and my mm-hmm. son and grief needed dedicated time, and that's why I made time for it. But now what I learned from that is, boy, when people show up to a grief group, I want to congratulate them on just getting there.
Yeah.
When people show up for grief counseling or therapy in general, I want to congratulate them.
Yeah. Hearing you talk about that, what it was like participating in a grief group, when some of them probably had your books as a resource, it reminded me in such a deeper way of that great quote from Ram Dass, we're all just walking each other home. And in that moment, right. You were all just walking each other home.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you a strange intersection. As you mentioned before we came on the air, I'm doing 30 cities and 3 countries right now. I'm doing the USA and the UK and Australia and going everywhere. And my first speaking gig, my first big speaking lecture was when Ram Dass got sick and I filled in for him.
Oh, my. Wow.
And I could tell you, it was a way to cut your teeth on, I'm not Ram Dass. So I knew I could never fill those shoes.
There are levels of celebrity, David. So, yeah.
Correct. And boy, that let me know what level I was at that time. And, you know, obviously... You know, and I've had to do that with a few other people, and people filled in for me when my son died.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. There's something about that that reminds us of the human condition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No matter who you are, something happens. There's going to be a work day you don't make, or something's going to happen someday.
Yeah.
You know, that humanity we all live in.
Yeah. I like what Marianne Williamson wrote regarding this book, and I know you two have been friends for a long time. She writes, Kessler writes of a world that is rarely examined with such sensitivity. Now he has gone into an even deeper and more soulful place. He's a healer par excellence into others who are in pain. Do you think, this gets back to the title of meaning, that through that death of your son, David, and walking through that grief, it's made you even a better healer and teacher?
Absolutely. Yeah. There is a deepness I never knew, and there is an X-ray vision I never had, and I'm sorry I have it, but I do.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'll tell you, it's sort of my way of making meaning out of David's life, and oh my gosh, Marianne's been so lovely about the book, and I'll tell you, Dan Siegel came out, Tony Robbins. I mean, people have just been really lovely about it. Amazing.
That's awesome. That's awesome to have that support from the community that you're close to. I'd like to have you elaborate just a little bit more on that sixth stage and its significance, which is meaning, because just hearing you talk about how it's even deepened the work that you've been doing, which was always amazing work in grief, I'm also thinking about the term life's purpose. Have there been people who, walking through grief, have discovered perhaps even their purpose in life through that? That deeper meaning?
Absolutely.
In life. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when we talk about meaning, it's important for people who are listening to know the meaning is not in the person's death.
Yeah.
The meaning is in their life. The meaning is with what you do with your life that honors them or connects with them. So many times when we talk about meaning, you know, people will hear about the person who started a foundation or a charity and have that big grand thing they did. But the truth is, meaning is found in moments. And meaning is found in the memories of their life and how we still connect with them and those continued connections.
Yeah.
And so... those moments, it can be, like you say, their life changed us forever.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe their death changed us forever.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps they died in a way we want to make sure no one else dies in that way, so we help others. Or, you know, it's making meaning is such an individual thing, and there's a million ways to do it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, we actually have in this world more post-traumatic growth than post-traumatic stress. But people don't often realize that, that finding meaning isn't extraordinary. It's actually ordinary if we allow ourselves.
You know, David, I'm glad you've come on the program at this time, because we are in the holiday season, and as you well know, and perhaps most of my listeners, that's a time when people are very sensitive to grief. It's an emotional time for a lot of people, and so I have a practical question for you. Those who are listening, and it could be with them or certainly a loved one or a friend who has gone through loss, and whether it be Hanukkah, Christmas, whatever it is, it's bringing up that grief. Are there phrases people tend to use that we should avoid saying to a person who's grieving?
Well, if someone's grieving, it's a moment to be there for them. It's not a moment to say, by the way, I had a death too 5 years ago, and let me tell you what that was like.
Mm.
It's a time to really be listening to folks, to be with them, to see them, as I mentioned earlier, not find that silver lining, just to know and to let them be however they may be in the holidays.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes we feel like connecting, other times we don't.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I would say is if you have someone who is coming over and it is a get-together, you know, I tell people in grief, we have to be the ones to sort of sometimes give people permission.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be the ones to show up at the get-together and say, I'm glad I'm here. It's so hard to be here without Frank. And let people know you can talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
But in the same way, if you're the host, you might want to say the same thing. You might want to say, we're so glad you're here, and we've all been thinking about you and Frank. And people go, oh, my goodness, I don't want to mention their loved one. I don't want to make them sad. And I remind people, they're sad already. You're just acknowledging the person who's died. Because I think the worst thing is when you go through the holidays and no one mentions your loved one.
Yeah.
And one of the other things is tell a favorite story about them.
Mm-hmm.
That's so important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let them know their grief is not taboo.
Yeah.
One of the things I've been loving is so many people, and I didn't even realize this when I was writing the book, this holiday season, they're buying the book like in droves as gifts. And I'm like, oh, I'm so glad that's happening. And someone said to me, well, you don't want to give your friend who's grieving a book that sort of feels like you're broken, get over it. But finding meaning sort of feels like this would honor your loved one.
Absolutely.
And I hadn't thought about that. So I'm thrilled that people are finding meaning as it is a gift this season, too.
Oh, I love what that person said. That makes total sense. Yeah, yeah.
Right, because you don't want to give someone 10 easy ways to get over your grief.
Well, yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Because first of all, there's not 10 easy ways. It's
right.
Not even, you know.
Right.
So.
Yeah, yeah. I'll tell you, living in the world as we all are now, and with 24-hour news cycles, we're so aware of so many tragedies that are taking place. There are things happening in the world that may not involve a loved one or even our own little community, but we're still affected by it. We hear about these tragedies on the news, and even though we're not affected directly, for me, it often feels like a loss. So, David, how do we grieve through this? In other words, is public grief real?
Public grief is real, but we want to be careful not to let it work against our own grief.
Hmm.
I've counseled someone who, you know, their mother died at 85 years and they're not allowing themselves to grieve. And I'm like, why aren't you allowing yourself to grieve? Well, my goodness, kids die in Sandy Hook. 80 years old is not a tragedy.
Huh.
I'm like, it doesn't have to be a tragedy, but it is your mama.
Yeah.
So you get to grieve her. And that's a whole nother tragedy of Sandy Hook, and don't confuse the two.
Yeah.
So the other thing is, if you're feeling like, oh, my gosh, the world, there's so much public grief, what helps is action.
Mm.
If you're feeling like there's collective grief, I don't know what to do, there's nothing we can do, there is.
Mm.
Give $5 to the Red Cross. Give a cause that's helping reduce shootings or mental health or however you feel about guns or whatever it may be, to take some action, even if it's small, to find meaning by making this world a place where those tragedies don't continue.
Hmm. It's important to distinguish, isn't it?
So it certainly is.
So you're saying that whether it be the loss of a child or an adult, or even our pets, a lot of people now are talking about...
Absolutely.
Yeah, is grieving process the same?
It is. You know, all griefs are different.
Mm-hmm.
I'm never going to know what it's like to have your house burned down. Hopefully not. Someone's never going to know what it's like to have their son David die. I don't know what it's like to another person whose son Janet died or their spouse died. I mean, we can't know each other's grief. We can only be present and witness it.
Yeah.
And One of the things that happened after my son died is a dance teacher we knew died at 43. Someone else's dog died at 17 years. Mm. And they were saying, why are you grieving us? And I'm like, because all tears count.
Yeah.
You know, all of our tears count, whether they're for our pets or our parents or our siblings, they all count.
Mm. Mm. When you were talking about that, I couldn't help but remember Lin-Manuel Miranda when he won the Tony for Hamilton. And he started, I believe, a speech. I don't have it in front of me, but love is love is love is love. And I thought, grief is grief is grief is grief. You can cry uncontrollably over the loss of a pet as well as a parent because
correct.
It hurts you. The pain is real for both. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
And we don't know each other's pain, and we never will.
Uh-huh. For people who are, let's say, stuck in grief, what's one thing that they can do to start moving forward in a healthy way?
They could take the words never and always out of their vocabulary.
Ah, okay.
So people will say, I'm never going to be happy again. I'm never going to be happy again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think of what Henry Ford said, whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right.
Yeah.
So if our mind is always repeating, I'm never going to be happy again, it becomes harder to be happy again. And you're not going to be happy right away. But when someone says, I'm never going to be happy again,
mm-hmm.
I say, wow, that's really a statement about how unhappy you are today.
Mm.
We actually don't know about next month or 6 months or 3 years or 5 years. So the same thing is true about we don't know. When someone says, I'm always going to be in pain. Well, today you're in a lot of pain.
Mm-hmm.
We actually don't know what tomorrow, next week, next month will bring.
Mm-hmm.
And to just sort of try to be in the moment with where you are. The second thing is, it's a byproduct of our self-help world. We're the first generation that has feelings on feelings. Like, I'm sad, but I shouldn't be sad. And I'm angry, but anger's bad. And we are always commenting on our feelings, and we end up with all these feelings half-felt.
Mm.
So I tell people, stay in your first-generation feelings.
Mm-hmm.
If you're sad today, then cry. If you're angry today, be angry. If you're okay today, it's okay to be okay today.
Yeah. Be in the present moment with what you're feeling.
Wherever you are, there's no right or wrong to grief.
Yeah. You had a remarkable connection with Joe Biden having to do with the mass shooting you talked about, or referred to at least a little earlier in our conversation, and you witnessed as a child. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. One day I was driving, and I pulled over because there was a call from the vice president, and we talked, obviously, about his son dying. And he had read my work and wanted to reach out, and I so was touched by that, and we talked. And then he asked me, you know, how'd you get in this work? And I told him about the mass shooting and all that. And I had known that his family had been killed, his wife, his child. When he first started his work, and he told me the first week in the Senate, after his own family had been killed, he had to show up and go to work to deal with this mass shooting, which was the mass shooting I was in as a child.
Okay.
So it was interesting that years later we sort of made that reconnection.
Yeah, yeah. Can you share a little bit more? It's been brought up a couple times now about that mass shooting when you were a child, a little more specific about what that was and how it affected you at such a young age.
Well, it went on for 13 hours. Law enforcement studies it now is like everything you don't do in a mass shooting.
Mm.
And it affected me that, you know, I saw so much chaos early on and so much loss.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost like, well, of course it broke my heart and changed the trajectory of my life.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, it gave me, it's funny, there weren't words to describe it then, but it gave me a bandwidth that allows me to deal with horrific things now.
Mm-hmm.
That I, you know, I'm able to walk into some of those horrible situations and help out in the world.
How old were you at the time, David?
I was 13.
13. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that will have to change a person to experience that. And unfortunately, with all the school shootings we have now, which is so sad, that's opening up a whole other area of grief work, isn't it?
Certainly, yeah.
Yeah. And speaking of that, what are your thoughts on how social media has impacted grieving?
Well, social media is certainly the new town square.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the good news about social media is, my goodness, if, you know, I have online classes, and by the way, no one's ever turned away for lack of funds in my online classes, so I want to always put that out there. But if someone's, like, online, and they're in a group, like one of my groups, and it's 3 a.m., and you're having a tough time, you can, like, chat with someone and post to someone who will get a response from them in Australia.
Yeah.
So it helps connect us in grief. The other thing is, you know, if your family doesn't want to talk about grief, you can go online and talk about grief.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So those are ways to connect us. You know, it's easy to be snarky and snide on social media. There's also a meanness that comes out in us that we would never have in person. So, you know, like everything, it becomes good and bad.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the work you did with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and how she impacted your life?
Well, Elizabeth had an authenticity that was just amazing. She would either, you know, she was just the most authentic person you've ever met, and she was an honest person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I happen to love her honesty. Her honesty bothered some people. But I certainly loved it. And, you know, I think she forever changed my world by being so kind and generous to me.
Mm.
So I'm certainly forever grateful for her.
So the authenticity is what really influenced you in all the work that she did.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And she seemed, I've never met her. But she seemed, from what I've read, humble in the celebrity that she gained in the work that she did.
Oh, yeah, she was. She was. She was just a authentic person, so authentic in the world, just lovely in all those aspects.
Hmm. Along those lines, I have to ask you this. What was it like when you got some kudos from Mother Teresa? She said, "This book is a source of reflection over that most mysterious and beautiful moment which awaits us all. It helps people to understand that death is a full surrender of ourselves to love, like a falling into the arms of God." That had to be somewhat heady to receive that some time ago.
Oh my gosh, I you know, no one ever could have thought they were going to get anything like that. For their first book especially,
yeah,
that was The
yeah.
Needs of the Dying,
yeah,
which is still a number one hospice book. And I, you know, to be honest, early on, there were times I thought I didn't deserve it.
Mm.
And one of the things that someone said to me at that point is, they said, "If you don't think you deserve it, earn it." So
I like that.
That's what I try to do, is I try to, you know, earn praise that I got from her.
Yeah, this is a great book. I would highly recommend our listeners pick up a copy of this. And you're leading Finding Meaning seminars in cities around the country. You talked about your website. Is that where they can find out more information?
Absolutely. Yes, they mm-hmm. can go to grief.com and look under events, or grief.com/events. And see all the different places I'm going to be at.
Yeah, that's awesome. And by the way,
I think I'm going to be in your city February 3rd, I believe.
You are. I saw that. I don't know where I saw that, but it's February 3rd. It's going to be in the Carmel area. They can find information about that by going on your website?
Absolutely. And I have a lot of counselors that come, but lay people also come. And, you know, professionals like me have grief. So, you know, many therapists and counselors come who are dealing with their own loss, too.
And by the way, if you are a therapist or a healer, professional healer, and you need CEUs, I believe you can get CEU credits for attending that as well.
Absolutely. This is a moment you can get them on such an important topic.
Yeah. You discuss in your book one truth that changes everything about dealing with our loved ones' possessions and will make it much easier. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. The idea, like, I think about my father's watch.
Mm-hmm.
My father's watch, I love it. It reminds me of him. I remember it being on his arm all those years. There's a couple of times I have almost lost it, and I have to remind myself that watch is not the greatest piece of evidence that he lived. I am.
Hmm.
You know, we are the storytellers. We are the ones who keep the memories alive. So we are the ones that hold that evidence.
Yeah. Again, the book is called Finding Meaning, The Sixth Stage of Grief. Information, David, about you, about this book, about your work across the country and even in the world can be found by visiting grief.com. And David, I just first of all want to thank you for sharing your time with me, but also you're just such a gift, I think, to the healing of humanity. So thank you for who you are and for the light that you continue and consistently shine in this world.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, and thank you for doing this, and I am so honored to take the time with you, Richard.
Blessings to you. And now, in keeping with the topic of death and dying, I'd like to play an excerpt from an interview I did about a year ago with Frank Ostateski, who was the co-founder of Zen Hospice Project and had a new book out called The Five Invitations. It was all about what the dying teach us about living. So here's about, 12 or 13 minutes of that interview with Frank. There is a great new book out. It's called The Five Invitations, Discovering What Death Can Teach Us About Living Fully. You know, life and death are a package deal. They can't be pulled apart, and we cannot live unless we are aware of death. Well, this book, The Five Invitations, is an exhilarating meditation on the meaning of life and how maintaining an ever-present consciousness of death can bring us closer to our truest selves. It's a joy for me to have the author of this great book is Frank Ostateski, who's dedicated his life to service. He's the co-founder of the Zen Hospice Project, founder of the Metta Institute, a Buddhist teacher, an international lecturer, and a leading voice in contemplative end-of-life care. He's been honored by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and AARP named him one of America's 50 most innovative people. He's offered seminars at Harvard Medical School, the Mayo Clinic, and the Heidelberg University, and he teaches at major spiritual centers around the globe. His work has been featured on the Bill Moyers PBS series On Our Own Terms and the Oprah Winfrey Show, among other programs. It's an honor to have him with us today, and he joins us from his home in Northern California. Frank, welcome to the program.
I'm happy to be with you, Richard.
I have followed your work for quite some time. Since you were on that Bill Moyers PBS special many years ago, I was a hospice chaplain at the time here in Indianapolis and was one of the many in many of the PBS stations across the country that were manning the phone lines and sending out information on that great special that Moyers put together.
Yeah, thanks for doing that. It was called On Our Own Terms. And
yeah.
Bill and I knew each other from some other circles. He invited me to be part of that, too. He was really trying to really change the way we look at death in America.
Yeah, he really was. I love this book that really has just come out, and I know you're doing a lot of traveling and seminars and workshops and such about this book. I wanted to start off by something in the introduction, the very first page. First of all, there's a beautiful Rilke quote. It says, "Love and death are the great gifts that are given to us. Mostly, they're passed on unopened." And the first sentence you write is, "Life and death are a package deal. You cannot pull them apart." And yet, Frank, it seems that we always are trying to pull them apart, especially when it comes to death in this country.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, we have a wish for mortality, for immortality. You know, all of us do in some way. I think our sense of self is terrified all the time of the dying process. But I think that we can find a deeper wisdom that that can be with that fear. And that's what the book is all about. How do you go toward death and learn what it has to offer you about living fully?
Yeah. So much of who we are and what we eventually become is, I think, influenced by people that have influenced us. And so before we get into the book, I wanted you to share a little bit about your experience with a couple of them. One was Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. You did have the joy of working with her, being trained by her. And, gosh, I can only imagine what that was like. But then also I'd like for you to share about somebody. Oh, he was near and dear in my heart. I never had the joy of meeting him. He was a very close friend of yours, and that was Stephen Levine, of course, his wife, Andrea. But can you share about both of those people, and what was it about them that had such an influence in you as you are now influencing so many people?
Well, thank you. I mean, Elizabeth, of course, was the great pioneer, the one who got us all on this path together. And I went to see her, honestly, when my son, my oldest son, Gabe, was being born. I wanted to understand how to bring his soul into his body. I sort of felt like that was my role. And she'd been so good at helping people get out of their bodies, I thought maybe she could give me some guidance. In effect, she wasn't so helpful in that regard, but she did sort of take me under her wing and allow me to sort of watch her, sort of shadow her.
Yeah.
And she was immensely intuitive and had a great big kind heart and was really brilliant at this work and fearless, absolutely fearless.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Levine had that same fearlessness. He was remarkably intuitive. He, of course, brought to his work something different than Elizabeth, which was a deep meditative practice, his Buddhist practice, but also from other traditions. And, of course, this really influenced the way in which he worked. And Stephen was extremely kind to me. When we first got the Zen Hospice going, I went to Stephen and I said, how do you think it's going to be, you know, having this Buddhist hospice? And he said, it's going to be all right if you don't make it too Buddhist. That was a really good reminder for me to really, you know, not get stuck in any kind of ideology or dogma.
Yeah.
And Stephen was really great at that. And he was really a great mentor for me and then later a dear friend. And he and Andrea have been, you know, great, great supporters of my work. And, you know, most of what I have done, I have modeled on their work.
I remember having Elizabeth Lesser, one of the co-founders of Omega Institute, on the radio show talking about her book, Broken Open. And I asked her of the thousands of people, the authors and teachers who have gone through the Institute, who was your favorite? Can you even answer that? And without missing a beat, she said, Stephen. Because he was so authentic. When people would meet him, he wasn't anything like they thought he should be. And he was just a rare, very rare individual, also very heartfelt in his presentations.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he was a kind of rebel.
Yes, you know? Exactly.
He was. He studied in a lot of different spiritual traditions, but he wasn't wedded to any one. And in that way, he could find his way into the heart of the people who came to his programs quite easily. He was very accessible, very real, and I modeled a lot of my work on what I learned from him.
Yeah, towards the end of our time together, I'd like to ask a little bit about the Zen Hospice project that you co-founded. But how did you follow a Buddhist path? Can we share just briefly about that for our listeners?
Well, sure. I mean, I think I got introduced to Buddhism quite early in my life, in my early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in a family that had some troubles. Both my parents were alcoholics. It was a difficult family upbringing. They both died young, my mother when I was a teenager, my dad a few years later. And to be honest with you, Richard, I tried everything possible to avoid that suffering, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. You know, I tried it all. And none of it worked, honestly. None of it worked in any lasting way, anyway. And when I came upon Buddhism, what it asked me to do was to turn toward that pain, to turn toward that suffering, and get to know it. It didn't ask me to believe anything. It just said, turn toward this experience.
Yeah.
And that was incredibly helpful to me. It was there that I really learned that turning toward that we were speaking about here is the ground of compassion.
Mm.
Right? And then it's become became a big part of my life, and it has been for the last 40-some-odd years.
Yeah, yeah. In this book that we're talking about, the five invitations are, don't wait. Welcome everything, push away nothing, bring your whole self to the experience, find a place of rest in the middle of things, and cultivate don't know mind. Can you share how you came up with those invitations, and what I thought was really hilarious, really, is how you came to write them down.
Well, the invitations really came from my working with people at the end of life. Mm-hmm. And in my case, working with people oftentimes on the margins of society, people who lived on the streets of San Francisco. And so if I was going to be with them, I had to really be real. Mm-hmm. And I had to be clear about my intention, otherwise they would sniff out my sentimentality and my insincerity. And so those precepts really came out of what they taught me, what these folks showed me as they came into the final weeks, days, and hours of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier Bill Moyers, and mm-hmm. Bill had invited, when he was preparing that show On Our Own Terms, he invited a number of us back to Princeton to have what he called a teach-in on death in America.
Mm-hmm.
And so I prepared a very salient talk, a really great, lecture. And I was on this panel with some other people who were leading figures in the end-of-life movement, and they took up all the time, and I never got to give my salient talk. And so Bill pulled me aside. We knew each other. He said, Frank, could you just, speak to the heart of the matter? So on the airplane there, I had written down on a cocktail napkin, I was just trying to make some notes for myself, the five things that I had really learned from being with dying. And it was the five invitations that you just named. So when Bill asked me to speak briefly to his crew, I pulled out my cocktail napkin, and they've actually been a kind of signature piece for me since then,
Yeah.
Because they're so, they can work on multiple levels.
Uh-huh.
At one level you can just look at them and don't wait. Okay, well everybody understands that, step fully into your life. But of course we can see the deeper and more subtle levels to those invitations as well.
Yeah, I think you refer to them as five bottomless practices.
Yeah, we can live into them in order to know them, I think.
Yeah. Well, the first one is don't wait. And you talk about when people are dying, it's easy for them to recognize that every minute, every breath counts. But the truth is, death is always with us. And I know you're passionate about that, is helping as many people as possible to embrace their own mortality, that it's a really healthy and wonderful thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, I've probably worked with a few thousand people who have died. And, a lot of them, honestly, came to their death full of fear, a significant amount of regret, and I just think it's not necessary.
Mm-hmm.
We don't. It's foolish to imagine that at the time of our dying we will have the physical strength, the emotional stability, the mental clarity to do the work of a lifetime.
Yeah.
And so we need to do this work now. And rather than being a depressing activity, Richard, I think really what I find is that when we understand how precarious this life actually is, we come to see how precious it is.
Oh, yeah.
And then we don't want to waste a moment. We want to step into our life with both feet, We want to embrace this life fully. We want to tell the people we love that we love them.
Yeah.
And so it's the brevity of life, it's the precariousness of life that shows us what's really important.
Mm-hmm.
I talk about how in Japan the hillsides are covered with cherry blossoms in the spring, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or in Idaho, where I go to teach often, there are these beautiful blue flax flowers that last for one single day. Now, why is it those cherry blossoms or those flax flowers are so beautiful to us? Isn't it their brevity which introduces us to their beauty?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's true with our life as well.
Yeah.
Because things end, they are valuable. Because things end, we must invest fully, fully in this life.
And in closing, I want to share some final words in his last chapter called Final Thoughts. David writes this: after all my years working with the dying and the grieving, I've found that in this lifetime, the ultimate meaning we find is in everyone we have loved. Your loved one's story is over, and for unknown reasons, their time on earth is drawn to a close, but yours continues. I can only invite you to be curious about the rest of the story of your life. You have most likely struggled with the acceptance of your loved one's death. Perhaps it's time for you to move on to the next stage of grief. Find your meaning. Your future is still unwritten. You have loved. You have experienced great loss. But life continues. Explore that. Be curious about that. You will never be the same. nor would you want to be. You can be whole again, however, and you deserve to be. When my boys were young, they would ask, "Daddy, do you believe in God?" And my answer was always, "Yes." And they would follow up with, "Well, how do you know for sure?" "Because I found you. There are millions of children in this world, and yet it was the two of you who came into my life. Our getting to be together is the miracle that makes me know God exists." Well, now that David is gone, do I think we will all somehow be together again in the next place? I do. Well, how will that work? I have no clue. I know that he has left this realm, but I sense unseen connections that bind soul to soul, and I believe these connections will survive death and unite us in the next realm, whatever and wherever that is. I always think about the twins in the womb story, and this is how it goes. In a mother's womb were two babies. The first baby asked the other, "Do you believe in life after this world?" The second baby replied, "Why, of course. There has to be something after this world." "Nonsense," said the first. "There is no life after this world. What would that life be? The umbilical cord supplies nutrition. Life after this would be impossible. The umbilical cord is too short. There can't be a world after this one." The second baby held his ground. "I think there is something, and maybe it's different than it is here. Maybe we'll see each other there." The first baby replied, "If there's another world, no one has ever come back from there. Leaving here is the end of life, and after delivery, there will be nowhere to go and nothing but darkness." "Well, I don't know," said the twin, "but certainly we'll see Mother, and she'll take care of us." "Mother?" the first baby guffawed. "You believe in a mother, an all-powerful, intelligent being that makes all this happen? Where is she now?" The second baby calmly and patiently tried to explain, "She's all around us. It is in her that we live, and without her, there would not be a world." "Ha! I don't see her, so it's only logical that she doesn't exist." To which the other replied, "Sometimes when you're in the silence, you can hear her, you can perceive her. I believe there is a reality after this world." David writes, "That story makes me think that just as an infant before birth could never imagine what life after birth could be like, or even believe it exists, we cannot imagine life after death. I think in some form, some way, I will see my parents, my nephew, and all those who have died before me, and mostly, I hope to see my dear son David again. He may know everything that has happened since he died, but maybe not. Maybe he and my mother and others will ask me about the gift of the years that followed their death. What did I do with that gift? What's my story? Did I make the last chapters of my life meaningful? I hope I have something interesting to tell them. My hope is the same for you. I hope you will have something interesting and meaningful to say about the rest of your life." The author is David Kessler. The book, Finding Meaning, The Sixth Stage of Grief, his website, grief.com. And that's today's program. I want to thank you again for joining me. I also want to thank engineer Kylan Talley and production coordinator Angel Richardson for making this possible. I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Journey's Fire. We're inspiring the fire within you, one broadcast at a time.